I'd like to remind all participants this conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. You may begin.
Thank you, Kelly. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everyone, and welcome to the IRTP Part D Working Group meeting on Monday, 14th of October 2013 at 15 UTC. On the call today, we have James Bladel, Avery Doria, Kevin Erdman, Rob Golding, Barbara Knight, Bob Mountain, Mikey O'Connor, Holly Raich. We have apologies from Paul Diaz. And from staff, we have Lars Hoffman and myself, Julia Chauvelin. May I please remind all participants to please state their names before speaking for transcript purposes. Thank you very much, and over to you.
Thank you, and welcome everyone to IRTPD. And as per our normal rules of procedure, does anyone have any updates to their statements of interest? If so, please raise your hand in the chat. No updates there, so we'll then draw your attention to the draft agenda, which was circulated on the mailing list and appears in the right-hand column of the Adobe chat room. Does anyone have any comments or edits to our draft agenda? It's fairly bare bones. Okay, seeing none, we'll just proceed with that. I think we'll spend the bulk of our call on agenda item number two, which is to bring back to the main group some of the efforts and work products coming out of the subgroup drafting team, which is working to review, revise, and revisit the TDRP and make some recommendations on how that process and policy could be restructured. Mikey has a mind map, and I think first off, on behalf of myself and Mikey and Christine, who were participating last week, we should probably just note to the group that we didn't think to record these sessions. So in the interest of transparency, we have collected our notes, and thanks to Mikey and Christine for collecting them as thoroughly as possible, and then we're presenting those to the group along with a walkthrough. And then going forward, we will also record those subgroup meetings and make sure that those are available with the other main group recordings and transcripts. So apologies for that, and we will remedy that going forward. So with that, we'll take a look here at the mind map that Mikey is sharing currently. And Mikey, I may actually turn over to you because we have maybe just if you can tee us up here on where we are with the revision of the TDRP, what sort of inflection points we have discovered or questions that we need to bring back to the group for a larger discussion, and where we are going here from here as a drafting team, and when we can maybe anticipate we'll bring this in for a landing and incorporate that into our draft initial report. So, Mikey, would you want to maybe kick us off in that regard?
Sure thing, James. This is Mikey. So what you see on the screen is this, it's pretty much the same document that we went through on the last call. I don't think I'll repeat all that, but we did record that call both in audio and in video. And so if you want to get a really detailed jaunt through our thinking, you can certainly do that. But let me just open up one layer. Essentially, what we concluded as a drafting team is that the TDRP, as it stands today, is very difficult to follow. It's a complex document that appears to have either been drafted in haste or badly revised several times along the way. And so we've put a fair amount of energy into just reorganizing it. And you can see from those headings that's sort of where we stand in terms of the policy part. Then we've broken out a lot of the more technical stuff. What do you have to do to file various things? What are the administrative procedures? And we've pulled them into a separate section. And then we've left a third section that presumably is taken care of by the TDRP providers. So that's an incredibly fast summary of what took the better part of the call last week, and I'm happy to go back into any of that.
Mikey?
Yes, sir.
Just for clarification, that the first three items here are simply summaries and reorganization of existing policy, no recommended changes or alterations at this point. Is that correct? Or
I wouldn't go quite that far. You know, we've got a lot of notes in there about things like one of the questions that's in our charter questions is the question of whether or not to remove the registry layer from this process. And so where we've encountered some things where we are thinking that the group is tending in a direction, we've generally annotated that, at least, in here and said things, you know, in regards to something like the registries, for example. We've annotated it and said this section would drop out. And for the most part, those annotations and changes are indicated in the draft so that it's fairly easy to pick them out. And I think the thinking at this stage is that once we get a couple of these last few questions for the group ironed out, we'll drive those all into a more traditional Word document draft and push that out to the list and then walk through it again fairly carefully so that we highlight those parts that reflect some, I guess what I would call good guesses on our part as to where we think the consensus of the group is. So I wouldn't say it's entirely the same, but it's certainly comprised, I guess, you know, 85 to 95%. It's the same. It's just reorganized a bit.
Yeah, thanks for clarifying.
Sure thing. So the thing that I thought would be really helpful to focus on today are three points. One of the points that came out when we were drafting was that in the case of registrar-initiated disputes, and because there are really two things going on. Registrars are initiating them, and there is the registry layer that precedes the dispute resolution provider layer. In the rules today. And so when I was copying and pasting language into the process for the registrant, the question came up. Right now there's a part of the process that allows registrars to dispute the findings of a registry, the first layer, and that dispute goes to a resolution provider. In the case of the registrant, first of all, because there is no, you know, presuming that we eliminate the registry layer, which, you know, I always have to put that caveat in, the only appeal that a registrant would be able to make, and in fact, it may be that the appeal process drops out altogether, because in the current policy, it says that decisions of a dispute resolution provider cannot be appealed. That if you want to appeal that decision, and this is at this point talking to registrars only, if you want to appeal a decision by a dispute resolution provider, you have to take it to court. What I did in drafting was start to build an appeal process for the registrant where the registrant could appeal a dispute resolution provider decision. And we backed that out because what we said was, look, if it's gone to a dispute resolution provider once, no matter who initiates it, that opinion cannot be appealed in this process. It has to go outside the process. Now, that's a decision that we didn't want to just make on our own. We wanted to highlight that and give the rest of you a chance to think about it, et cetera, et cetera. And so that's the first of the three questions that we've got for you today. James, you're in the queue. Take it away.
Yeah, thanks, Mikey. Just a couple of questions about this. To summarize, because the process is now beginning at the DRP level, that would have been under the status quo. That would have been where the appeal would have gone if it had already exhausted the registry level. So, in a sense, they're starting the dispute at the appeal level. Right.
Yeah, that's right, and that's why I sort of backtrack in the middle of my little.
Okay. I generally support this idea. My question, however, is just to sanity check our work here. Where do we have parallels that we can point to in other policies like UDRP or some of the new dispute resolution policies that are coming up that we can say that, you know, look, once something has gone to an independent panel, it's essentially the decision stands unless you want to go outside of the ICANN process and into, you know, a court proceeding because, you know, we have to have like a, you know, there has to be a stop point to this process at some point, right? We can't build appeals and then appeals to the appeals, so on and so forth. I get where you're going with this. I'm just wondering if there's an analog we can point to in other policies.
There's certainly one in this policy, which is that's the policy today. And, you know, Barbara, you may want to comment on that. But in the policy today is that stopping point that says once it's been to a dispute resolution panel, it can't be appealed. And with that, I'll head over to Barbara, and then we'll note that we should take a look at analogs in other policies. Barbara?
Thank you, Mikey. This is Barbara. So, I mean, I think that just for clarification, I mean, both the registry operator today and the ICANN-designated UDRP, or ICANN-approved, I should say, UDRP providers are considered UDRP providers, and basically it's just that the registry operators at this point are considered a level one dispute provider, while the URDP, like the NAF and all of those, are considered the level two. There's nothing to preclude someone today from bypassing level one and going directly to level two. Under the current policy, the way it's written, they have the option to do that, but if they go to level two, then they can't, and if they don't like the answer there, then they can't come back to level one. So there really would be no difference if we were to eliminate level one altogether and just have, you know, the level two providers, such as, you know, NAF, be, you know, the sole provider, if you will. I'm curious, and I'm not familiar enough with the UDRP to see exactly what it says, because, you know, if we were to eliminate the first level, the registry level, and just have the level two providers available as the recourse for transfers activity that's done in violation of the policy, I would think that it would follow more closely to what's happening under the UDRP. Do we have anybody yet? Is Christine on the call today? I haven't
seen her yet, unfortunately, because she's pretty smart about the UDRP.
Yeah, I'm thinking she would be able to tell us, you know, if, you know, what happens in the event that somebody doesn't like a UDRP decision, and do they then have to go to the courts, which is basically what the transfer dispute policy envisions in the case that the second level decision is not agreed, you know, somebody has an issue with it, I should say.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, one way to view this is to say, well, the way we're describing it is the way the TDRP is today, and so we're not changing it. But it would be, I think, a good thing to check out the appeal provisions in a UDRP and just see if we can normalize these gracefully. That would be good, I think. If it turns out they're wildly different and there are policy issues that arise, that would also be a good discussion for this group to have. So I'm certainly open to the idea of comparing it to the UDRP. Let's wave our hands at that problem for a minute and just make sure, because I think that basically what happens is, rather than the question of should we provide an appeal mechanism within this policy to the registrants, in a way, the question is, have we just eliminated the need for an appeal mechanism for the registrars if we eliminate the level one layer? And I think that's true, because I think the appeals are all aimed at appealing registry decisions. They're not available to appeal a TDRP provider decision. So I just want to take a sanity check on this and tentatively mark it down as that's the way we'll go. We'll certainly bring it back once we get to final form, but this is the time for sort of howl of outrage. Barbara, go ahead.
Thank you, Mikey. This is Barbara for the record. I just did a really, really quick scan of UDRP policy and the rules for the word appeal, and it's not coming up anywhere, so I don't know if there is any mechanism for appeal under the UDRP. It may be, just be that, you know, if they don't like it, then the next step would be to go to the courts in that case as well.
That doesn't
surprise me. Barbara, this is James, and I think that is also my understanding, but, you know, was just looking to confirm that.
Yep, sounds good.
Yeah, and I'm not surprised, because there isn't a first layer at the registry. I think that's what the word appeal in this document is aimed at. So I think we're all kind of landing on the same place. And so we'll take that on board in the drafting team and work that in. We'll highlight all this stuff so that it's not invisible by any means. Okay, let's move on to the next one. The next one is, one of the things that we've been saying in the conversation about a registrant initiating one of these is that they have to clear a certain number of hurdles before they can do this. And so we put some numbered stubs in the draft, but we would be really interested in sort of a brainstorming session with you all as to what those hurdles might look like. I hesitate to... Tell you what, I'm going to stop sharing my screen for just a second so that I don't just totally take your eyes out of their sockets while I drive quickly around the draft and find the... We came up with a first try at these, and I don't want to drive you crazy while I find it. And so while I'm stumbling around, please do think about sort of what sorts of things people would need to do if they were registrants and they were filing one of these complaints. I wonder if I took it out. Finding it. I could have sworn that I put this in here.
Different here. Oh, Mikey, this is James.
Go ahead, James. I'm all ears.
Don't we first need to, maybe I'm jumping the gun a little bit on your notes here, but don't we first need to establish whether the difference between graduates from being a just Joe Blow off the street to a registrant claimant, in this process, how they establish that they have some claim to previous registrant status for the domain name?
I think that's precisely the kind of stuff that needs to go in here. I think this is the screen. Here we go. I'm going to copy over the three guesses that I had in my first try at the draft, and then I'll put this back up on the screen here for you. And I apologize for dropping my screen off, but believe me, you didn't want to watch what I was doing. So there it is. So these were the three that I sort of remembered from prior discussion, that registrant claimant would have to document their attempt to settle through a registrar, that they would have to then provide presumably some more documentation to back up the TDRP, and perhaps documentation that a registrar was not initiating a TDRP for them. Because remember that the normal process here would be that if the registrars couldn't resolve it registrar to registrar, they would initiate the TDRP. That's the initial trigger for this. And what we're doing is essentially opening this process up in the case that a registrar does not, presumably because they don't think it's justified or something like that. And so the registrant or the registrant claimant would need to document why the registrar didn't do that for them. So these were sort of very first rough guesses. And James, back to you.
So from a registrar perspective, if I refuse to provide this documentation, I can essentially stop the TDRP from proceeding?
Well, that would be a bad outcome, wouldn't it? This is precisely the reason that this conversation needs to take place.
Okay. And so we're going this route. And sorry, I'm not sure if I'm wearing a registrar hat anymore. I'm just kind of helping brainstorm through this. But we're going through this process because we believe that there are two scenarios under which a registrar would decline to initiate a TDRP. One is that the registrar does not believe that the claimant will prevail. Either their status as a previous registrant is questionable, or they look at the transfer and, you know, everything looks legitimate, and they don't see any particular failings in the policy level, so they just want to leave it alone. The other one would be that the registrar simply refuses because, you know, it looks like a lot of work and paperwork and expense, and they don't have to do it, but why should they? And, I mean, just what am I trying to say here? Obstinance? Just the registrar just doesn't want to go along. I don't really know if they have anything to lose, necessarily.
I think that's right, and I think that.
What skin do they have in the game, I guess, at this point?
Right, and I think that that's sort of the thought that went into that last bullet, was to say, okay, this is available to a registrar, mm-hmm. or a registrant, sorry. But they have to tell the story of how they got there. And I suppose that one version of the story would be, you know, if we follow your scenarios, one version of the story is, well, the registrar wrote me back and said, we've failed to resolve your dispute between the registrars, and we, your registrar, don't believe that you're going to prevail. That's not to say that you can't undertake this on your own, but we aren't going to support you in that effort. And the other is essentially and that to me is something that comes to the registrant in email or somehow, and they attach it to their request for this proceeding. And the other is the obstinate registrar who uh, simply doesn't go along with them. And that's harder to document because it's harder to document a non-action. but
which is the whole point of us opening this up to registrants directly, right?
Right.
Not the registrars who look. Though I've looked at your stuff here. I've looked over your materials. I looked over the transfer, and I don't think you have a case, so I'm not proceeding. Those weren't the folks that we were going after. It was the folks who were not communicating, not responding, or just said, you know, this looks like a lot of paperwork and a lot of ICANN BS, and I don't really want to get involved.
Right.
And so I guess I'm a little hesitant to require that the registrant obtain some sort of blessing, even if it's documentation, that they talk to that registrant, because it gives them a veto over this. I think maybe we might have to take a look at that, because it seems like the very people we're trying to help here are still on the critical path.
Well, we could put this in as optional documentation for now, tentatively. Because I think you and I are heading in the same direction there, James. We don't want to give the obstinate registrar a veto over the ability to proceed, for sure. Well, let's put maybe a goal in there, too.
But that opens up the flip side as well, which is that we need the, I want to say, original losing registrar to be able to vouch for the identity of the person making the claim, that they had some involvement with that domain name in the past. And who else could possibly make that claim? Or who else could substantiate that claim?
Couldn't the registry and the Whois database do that?
For thick registries.
Ah, yes. Gosh, I wish we had thick registries. Yeah, right. Well, wait a minute, let me type for a minute. You know, that sort of dovetails into the conversation we had on the drafting team last week about the fees and the fact that the fees are a little bit overloaded right now, and that one of the components of the fees is to compel participation by the registrar. I don't know.
Yes.
If those go together or not. I mean, a pretty empty queue. This is an interesting puzzler. So I think what we may do is leave this for now. I like the scenarios and the goals that we've come up with. Thanks for those, James. And we'll put this on the needs more puzzling pile at the moment, but don't feel like we're done, folks, because I'm not seeing anybody jumping into the queue. Barbara, you got any ideas about this in terms of what you've seen? You're sort of our resident expert on how these kinds of things unfold. Any thoughts come to mind?
I'm going to apologize. This is Barbara. Somebody just walked into my office and disrupted me, or distracted me, I should say. So, can you give me a quick rundown? I'm so sorry.
No, no worries. I didn't mean to really put you on the spot like that. And I noticed your offer to join us on the drafting teams, and I'm going to accept that offer with great joy. But this one is still in the undecided puzzler stage for sure. And Avery in the chat is pointing out that registrants are going to have to have some sort of evidence to present. And I suppose, James, that one way to do this is to say that the dispute resolution provider it's sort of in their lap to verify the identity of the registrant or the veracity of their claim. And since the claim that they're the registrant is sort of the core of the whole dispute anyway, maybe we leave that in the lap of the dispute resolution provider and we don't force the registrant or the registrar to necessarily be required to do that. That would be another way through. Barbara, over to you.
Thank you, Mike. So this is Barbara. So, I mean, today the way it works is, you know, we obviously get all of the information from the registrars, and, you know, we have to rely on, you know, the fact that the registrars are validating who the registrant is, and if there's, you know, claims of hijacking and all of that, that, the, you know, the person who has brought it to their attention, you know, is legitimate. So all of that happens today before the registries ever get to it. And, you know, unfortunately, I can say from VeriSign's standpoint, you know, we are a thin registry, so we don't have any information in our databases to be able to do any sort of validation of the registrant. So, again, that's, you know, we rely very heavily on the registrars to do that. But I guess my question is, you know, when we're talking about this, are we talking about the fact that, you know, if a registrant is wanting to bring this because they're claiming that the registrar is not willing to bring the claim on their behalf, I mean, doesn't that then become more of a compliance issue with the registrar not really being in compliance with a consensus policy and raising those disputes if they're not able to resolve them? And would we not then pursue it from that perspective if we get a complaint in, basically, you know, pursuing it through the registrar to say, you know, this is what I'm doing would happen if someone were to come to VeriSign, you know, a registrar today, claiming that their registrar would not, you know, raise the dispute for them, is, you know, our position would be to go back to the registrar and basically ask them why they are not willing to raise that dispute or open the case on behalf of the registrant, given that, you know, the TDRP under the IRTP is a consensus policy and they are expected to do that on behalf of the registrant.
Yeah, and I would think, Christine's on the call. Cool. I would think that the dispute resolution provider would probably do the same thing. Go to the registrar and ask for that documentation. I think the original thinking behind this step, you know, we've got sort of a trade-off here. We want to give registrants access to a process, but we don't want to flood the process with spurious requests. And so the thought was, you know, let's put some hoops in front of it to stop that behavior, you know, motivate better behavior on the part of registrants. And it may be that this is better handled by putting that in the process that the dispute resolution providers do. James, go ahead.
Hey, Mikey. James speaking. You know, I'm all for punting this issue of verification over to the dispute providers, but I don't think that anyone, including the registries, has anything, has any authoritative information except for the registrar. So I still feel like we can't get around this issue of the registrar being an obstinate registrar being able to hold up the process. But something Barbara said just a moment ago kind of, I think, well, I want to noodle on it a little bit more. Is, you know, there are two ways of opening this process up to registrants, and I think we've been focused maybe on one of those means, which is to allow them to immediately initiate the process with the dispute level, or the dispute, second level of dispute provider. But what if we were to take another look at this and say, is it possible that we could simply solve or address this issue by requiring registrars to initiate a TDRP when it's brought to them with, you know, some basic provisions to make sure that they, you know, they have some history with this particular, the person making the claim. And, of course, you know, you can't force someone to take an action and then also hold them accountable, if you know, financially, if that action fails. So it just, it feels like if we can work that out, that might be another way to ensure that registrants have access to this policy without kind of creating a whole new separate path through the policy. And that was just something I need to think about it a little bit more before I actually can kind of throw it out to the, you know, for consideration. But it was just something, as long as we're brainstorming, I wanted to put on the table.
I'm going to put that in there as a note. I'm going to hang your name on it, James.
That's fair. I deserve that.
Because I'm not adverse to that idea. I think the goal that I've always been striving for is some way for a registrant to overcome the registrar who elects not to file the TDRP for them.
Right.
For either of those scenarios. And if we can figure out the mechanics of requiring that, and it does sort of head in a way to the fees piece.
It starts to resemble the sort of compliance inquiries that we already receive, which is, hey, registrar, somebody requested a transfer and you knacked it. You declined the transfer. Under what basis are you declining the transfer? And as a registrar, the burden of proof is on us to demonstrate that one of those reasons for denials, was met. And so I think a similar thing could be, hey, registrar, your registrant refused to, or you came to you and asked you to initiate a TDRP and you refused. Why? And which of the four reasons, that are allowable are you claiming here? And a registrar would be on the hook for saying, we believe this is a spurious claim. We believe that the transfer policy was followed because of X, Y, and Z or whatever. I mean, I think the burden of proof can be pushed back onto the registrar why they didn't. Or they could say, upon further review, we have decided we will initiate this TDRP. And I think that then it becomes, I think what Barbara was aiming at was it becomes a compliance action then for the registrar to cooperate, not a fee for, a gold star for doing the right thing and a fine for doing the wrong thing. It becomes more of a built into the compliance framework.
Yeah, now the one scenario that we'd have to, let's noodle on that some more. That's a good idea. Avery's asking, in Thiku, is our registrar still the only ones with authoritative information? And the answer there is it depends on what you mean by authoritative.
Contact information, I think the answer is yes.
Yeah, and authoritative in the sense that it's the registrar that gathers the information from the registrant. However, it's carried in the ThicWhois registry database, and essentially the stories that we've heard is that people look both places and use both as their source. So authoritative is tricky. That's that whole authoritative section that we worked on in ThicWhois, Aubrey. Let's take another. We got about 10 minutes left. And we had a brainstorming session not unlike the one we just had in the drafting team. And we came up with some, oh, it's too big. Well, we'll just have to do this a piece at a time. Sorry. One of the things that comes up in this process when you give this, give access to this to registrants, is who pays the fee? And so one of the things that and this came up a bit on the call last week, and we took that discussion into the drafting team and broke it into smaller and I think more manageable bite-sized pieces. Because what we've kind of tentatively arrived at is that the fee charged to registrars right now is overloaded, especially if we are giving access to this process to registrants. Partly the fee is to disincent frivolous or fraudulent claims, especially in the case of a registrar or a registrant. But it's also to provide incentives to actively participate. So in that case, it's generally something that we want the registrars not to have to pay because they're just participating. It's also a form of a sanction, and we get into some interesting territory when we talk about uniform sanctions across all consensus policies, and yet here we have a sanction built into the TDRP. And it's also used to pay for the dispute resolution providers. That's a lot of luggage for a single fee to carry. And I think we had a very useful discussion as we teased those pieces apart. So then when we looked at the sanction piece, you've probably read ahead on the screen, but I'll walk through it if anybody's on the phone. We uncovered a couple of problems with the sanction part of the fee. One problem is that in the case of a multi-hop hijacking case, the two registrars that are actually involved in the TDRP process may not be the registrar that actually did the misdeed. And so if you charge either end of that process, you're essentially sanctioning the wrong registrar. So that was one. And then the second is the point that I made a minute ago, which is that we have this emerging consensus that we don't want to build sanctions into policies, but rather have them carried at the RAA level. And then from that point, it gets a little crazy. Some of this is from our discussion, and some of it arguably came from my demented mind. One of the things that we thought about was the possibility of splitting the fee into different pieces so that we unload it a little bit. And then one of the pieces of that could be a fee for registrar non-participation. And, James, this is the part that I was thinking about when we were noodling away earlier about getting the registrar to participate, is that this is another piece to that puzzle. Then there's the filing fee, where if the registrar or if the registrant loses or is determined to be fraudulent or frivolous, then that filing fee is retained by the DRP provider, and that's an incentive to keep people from filing silly, long shot cases. This is the really crazy piece that I still swear James said, but James stoutly maintains that I hallucinated this, and given my past, I'm willing to take that on board. But, you know, you can have the two-beer discussion about who pays those taxes, but a tax is paid on every domain name, generic domain name, that goes to fund ICANN. And maybe what we do is we take a portion of that fee and establish a fund that actually pays for the DRP services rather than clumping all these things together in one fee, break them apart a bit. And then a couple other points that came out is maybe one of the things that we do is we add language that says that the DRP can identify where the fault and blame was. This is sort of aimed at that middle registrant in the chain of a multi-hop process. And maybe one way to handle that issue is to aim that back to ICANN compliance. And then the last idea we had, and I see, James, you've got your hand up. Let me just rip through this, and then I'll jump over to you. Is this notion that maybe we allow registrars to pass fees along to their customers. And again, this is kind of in early brainstorming mode. These don't necessarily all fit together very well yet. And so I'm not presenting this as a single option, but rather sort of pieces of a clock that we might be able to assemble into something that would be fair to all. And with that, James, over to you.
Thanks, Mikey, and I'm trying to remember which part is a good run-through, and I'm trying to remember specifically where I wanted to comment here, but I think when we were talking about the ICANN fee, part of our discussion on Friday was an observation that ICANN does or is involved in a number of functions, and in some cases is using its general fund, if you will, to pay for certain dispute resolution processes or to subsidize certain functions that might otherwise be too costly, but had been deemed, you know, part of the public interest. And I just wanted to point out that transfer disputes, transfer issues, are still far and away the most common issue that ICANN receives complaints about from the general public. And in fact, you could make the argument that if someone has never heard of ICANN before, their first introduction to ICANN is most likely going to be through a transfer of a domain name that failed for some reason. So I think this is, I just want to point out that while this seems like we're kicking the ball over the fence here and saying, okay, we can't figure out who's going to pay for this ICANN, you're on, you know, this is going on your tab. I think there is a little bit more of a case to be made for the idea that this is one area where where the community served by ICANN and all the commercial service providers and all the dispute resolution providers is screaming for assistance here, and I think that it shouldn't be dismissed that they would have some role to play in offsetting these fees.
Thanks, Jame. A wonderful endorsement of my hallucination. it's getting close to the top of the hour. Does anybody else have any reactions to this? This one, the drafting team doesn't feel like it's baked yet by any stretch of the imagination, but we'd certainly be interested in any of your thoughts about this. This is sort of top of our agenda for our next call. And,
just a thought, Mikey, if I could jump in on that. Maybe just a note that we will take this up again in our sub-team on Friday, right?
Right.
And do we want to maybe re-invite anyone who really wants to weigh in on some of these issues? I don't want to give the impression that it's a small and select group of folks that are, this isn't an expert working group or a strategy team or something like that. This is, just more of a coalition of the willing, right?
Yeah, and I think that's a great idea. I think one of the things we might want to do is hit the list with that. Lars, I might lean on you to do this. And essentially re-invite, send out essentially a meeting announcement to the whole list with the invitation that says, anybody who's interested in joining, certainly more than welcome. Barbara has mentioned in the chat that she'd be willing to join, and I'm very enthusiastic about that because, you know, I think Barbara brings probably the deepest understanding of this process in the working group to the crew. And so, yeah, I think that's a great idea. I'm seeing a check mark from Lars. Thanks, Lars. And I think with that, James, back to you to wrap us up. I'm done here.
Okay, thanks, Mikey. And I think you did a very thorough and comprehensive job of covering everything on our agenda today. So our next meeting will be next week. And same time, same channel. It looks like, Lars, you have an announcement?
Yeah, thanks, James. Just very briefly, this is Lars. We're changing in Europe. We're changing to winter time in the last weekend of October, which then means that the timing for the call will be slightly different with regards to the UTC. I believe in the States and in Canada, the change is, and I'm not sure about Australia, to summertime, the change is a different week, the week, 1 week later for North America. What we did in the spring, if I remember correctly, was to keep the time at the UTC until everybody had changed and then switch the time back, the UTC time back to basically keep it at the same time that we're meeting right now, the same local time. But so Europe would be actually for 1 week. If we did it this way, there would be no change in for the U.S., UTC time would change, and Europe would have 1 week of a different local time for the meeting, 1 week, 1 hour later. If you're happy with that, I can also explain it more clearly in an email, I suppose.
I think that's fairly understood, and I think that what we're saying is that we would kind of lock this time slot in with, are we saying North America then? Because I think Holly is saying that Australia is already on daylight savings.
Yep.
So yes, James, we would lock it in with the local time in America, adjust the UTC, and we here in Europe would have a 1 week different timing of the call.
Okay, and I think that would probably be the least. One meeting would be 1 hour off for some of the participants. That would probably be the least confusing and impactful way to do that. Of course, I say that as someone who would not be affected by that. But but in general, it seems like that would be the simplest way to proceed.
James, let me just jump in. This is Mikey. Lars, I think it would be good to do the same for all working groups.
Yeah, Marika and I have discussed this, and that is the way that we're thinking to do it for all the groups. But we thought we raised it with the individual groups just to see if there's any objection.
Yeah, that's great. But my hope would be that we do it all the same, because otherwise,
yeah, I know.
We'll tangle people up pretty badly, I think.
Yes, sir. No, that's the goal for sure. Absolutely.
Okay, with that, I would say we'll pick up this group then with the sub-team this Friday, and then this group same time next week.